This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. American roots music is the specialty of my guest, Rai Cooter. He's made around 10 albums featuring his versions of blues, jazz, gospel, depression ballads, Tex-Mex, and rock and roll. He's an accomplished guitarist who first built his reputation on his bottleneck technique. Cooter's done a lot of guitar session work, composed many movie scores, and now he's in a supergroup of performers who've never been superstars. The band Little Village is made up of four individualistic performers, John Hyatt, Nick Lowe, Jim Keltner, and of course Cooter, each of whom has had a devoted following of their own. They first worked together on Hyatt's 1987 record, Bring the Family. For their new album, Little Village, Cooter, Keltner, Hyatt, and Lowe collaborated on writing the songs and alternated on lead vocals. Here's Rai Cooter singing. Is Little Village getting you back into touring and performing? And had you practically given that up?
Oh no, far from it. I mean, I like to play. I don't like to tour because I don't like to travel that way. But we all love to play, so naturally you have to find an excuse. You know, you have to say, well, if it's going to be a record project, we'll have an excuse to call us together or get people together, or if we're going to go out and go for the kind of physical spontaneity part or the vibe part, we'll go out and tour and play and hit the stage and go for broke and try it, you see. And that's a kind of a thing that you look forward to doing. It's just that some of the stuff I've done, it hasn't been particularly high profile, I must say, although You want to, most musicians I know, they want to kind of try different things. They want to stay wondering, you know, stay on the what-if side. That's the best part about being a musician. What-if is calling you all the time.
Over the years, you've learned and played so many different kinds of music, all forms of blues, Tex-Mex, Hawaiian music. I'm wondering if there's a music that you consider to be your roots.
No, well, Well, that's interesting. I've never thought about that really. There's so much I've heard for so many years. Although maybe Johnny Cash. I mean, the first thing I ever heard that I really related to on the radio as a child was Johnny Cash. I mean, after hearing Beethoven and stuff, but I can't say that Beethoven's a root guy for me. But I mean, before Woody Guthrie is there, and there's a kind of a funny area of music hardly made anymore by marginal white people that I really loved as a kid, which was this kind of country blues thing, and it's also played by black people, of course, you know. But I mean, early on, before I ever heard blues players, I heard Woody and I heard Johnny Cash, and I used to think, these guys are really, wherever they are, and I had no idea where they were. You know, I lived in Santa Monica. As far as I knew, this was what life was. I had no idea, you know, that there was another world or culture or lifestyle out there. And, you know, I would have loved to have gone to these places, but the best thing I could do was turn on the radio at the time.
Do you think of yourself now as or have you thought of yourself over the years as a marginal white person?
Yeah, I sure do. I mean, I think that's the best place to be, is on the margin, out there on the periphery somewhere, hanging on, because it allows you to do two things. You can see in. You have a kind of a luxury if you're on the edge looking in. You can see the whole picture if you've trained yourself or if you're in the habit of looking that way. And music's a way of seeing, you know. It's a way of understanding people or situations or life or the world through the sound. If you listen in, you hear things other than notes, is all I'm saying. And the other good thing about being on the margin is you see out away from the middle. So you're sort of, you know, and you can drop off the planet a little once in a while and go see the Tex-Mex guys in McAllen, Texas, or the Hawaiian folks over there and on the beach somewhere, you know, because you're not committed or you're not locked into a, one way or another of seeing and thinking, you know. So I tend to stay on the edge, the periphery there, as long as it's possible anyhow.
How were you exposed to blues when you were growing up?
Well, it was hard to be exposed to blues living in Santa Monica, you see. There wasn't anybody playing blues. And then you could listen to radio station KGFJ. Hunter Hancock would once in a while sneak in a Jimmy Reed record or something like maybe Lowell Fulson or somebody. And so you said, well, that's different. That's interesting. And then along came the folk revival and the blues revival attached to it, like the baggage car, or actually the coal car, the burner. And along came Chris Strachwitz, and he with our Hooley Records, and he found Lightning Hopkins for us, and brought us, you know, he brought us in to see some people like that. And there was the Ash Grove, the nightclub in L.A. that featured some of these by then older guys who were still active. And as far as they were concerned, it was just another way of making some money, and another audience happened to be white. And of course, for me, it was tremendous just to get in a car and drive to Hollywood and see these guys like Mississippi John Hurt and Sleepy John Estes, just apparently from Mars or some planet, where people looked like this, talked like this, had strange clothes and shoes that turned up on the toes with the orange soles. I just could not imagine where these people were coming from, but you knew you wanted to go with them. It's Pied Piper-like thing, you know. I must have been about 12, 13 when all that started to happen.
Were you ever disappointed by how they sounded in person?
Oh, yeah. I wanted it to be just like the record. At first I did, anyhow. I thought, can't he play that lick I love so much? Then I learned, of course, that's not the way music works. That's not the way people work. See, it's an education there. And it was fun then to find that things could change and you didn't have to... In other words, it wasn't just a matter of recreating. If you wanted to experience this music, you weren't really supposed to recreate in yourself what had happened at that moment in time in, say, 1929 or 1940 or something. You were just supposed to just learn to surf across the wave of this thing, you know, just catch the groove. But nobody can tell you that. You have to kind of feel that for yourself, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is guitarist and composer Ry Cooter, and he's now playing with the band Little Village, which also includes John Hiatt, Jim Keltner, and Nick Lowe. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ry Cooter, and he's now a member of the group Little Village, along with John Hiatt, Jim Keltner, and Nick Lowe. Early in your career, you did some session work with groups like Paul Revere and the Raiders, and they had the hits like Kicks and Good Thing, and Jackie DeShannon, who recorded What the World Needs Now, and you were on one of the Stones records doing some studio work. How did you get from, you know, the folk scene to studio work?
Yeah. Well, that was quite a leap, although it wasn't the leap it is now. I mean, I guess what happened was, There was suddenly a moment when folk rock was viable commercially. You know, it, I guess thanks to Bob Dylan and then the Byrds, and this all hit in L.A. like a ton of bricks. I mean, it really went off. It set a lot of flares up. See, and suddenly everybody was into music and the Beatles and everything. And I went to Santa Monica High School. You know, music was considered just as ridiculous. It was absolutely de classe, outre thing to be interested in, even talk about, until the Beatles had their hit, and then everybody started letting their hair grow and talking about this stuff. I mean, it was like a social fact. It was like an atmosphere in your life that was never to go away. So I was, of course, very contemptuous. I thought, you know, these people just don't understand. We already knew that, you know, this stuff is already out there. So since I had no, I didn't relate to what was going on in school and things, and so used to hang out with musicians who were older and hung out at these little folk clubs and stuff. And by and by, Taj Mahal appeared on the scene. He came out from Cambridge. And we would sit around and play, and we liked the same stuff. So he said, well, look, these guys, the Byrds, they're working. There's Bob Dylan's, he's working, you know, let's us work. And so we went to Ed Pearl, who ran the Ash Grove, and said, here we are, and give us a job. And he did, naturally. You know, didn't pay us anything, but said, open for somebody, you know, just do some songs. And then we did that, and then, make a pretty long story, little shorter we went on, and the record companies had awakened to the fact that they might have somebody out there, there might be something they could do, and turn this sort of folk garage band thing into product, you know. And we got signed to Columbia Records, and we had this band, and it was terrible. But it was really no good for anything except that it got us in the door at the record company, which in those days, that door was big and it was closed.
So how did you get signed to play your own music after doing studio work?
Well, I had done a lot of studio work with Lenny Warnker, who, he's the president of Warner Brothers Records now, actually. At that time, he was an A&R man, a producer. And he was producing Randy Newman and Van Dyke Parks, sort of. Gosh, I forget now. There I go, forgetting. But anyhow, we worked together a lot, and I don't know, at some point there was some conversation, I suppose. I might have said, I think I should make a record, and he said, I think you should make a record, or something. And it wasn't any more ceremonial than that, and I was about 23 at the time.
Let me play something from your first album, which was called Rye Cooter, and I think I'll play the Sleepy John Estes song, Going to Brownsville. This is you on mandolin.
Yeah.
Doug
Kershaw's on accordion on that one, I think.
So mm-hmm. Tell me something about your arrangement for this and playing blues mandolin.
Well, Sleepy John had a man he worked with, Yank Rachel, who was the blues mandolin player of choice, I guess, and that whole style, it's such a wonderful, hidden, forgotten thing. I mean, the jug band style that preceded Sleepy John Estes, and he kind of went into it in his own funny, weird way. And then I went into his tune in my weird little funny way. It's just a process, you see, how rhythm is and how instruments are approached, and that's kind of what this is all about, you see. It's what can you do with something as simple and basically primitive as that? Two chords and just a mood.
This is Rye Cooter from his very first album, the very first song he recorded. It's Going to Brownsville.
I'm going to Brownsville. Take that right hand roll. Well, I'm going to Brownsville. Take that right hand roll. And I ain't gonna stop walking till I get in sweet mama's door.
Most of your recent recordings have been soundtrack recordings, including Paris, Texas, probably your best known, The Long Riders, Johnny Handsome, name a few more.
Oh, Alamo Bay, Louis Malle film, that was a nice one.
Mm-hmm.
I like that one, and Crossroads is another one of Walter Hill's pictures I worked with him on. Mm-hmm. A good blues story, had a lot of good stuff. The Border was a great one with Jack Nicholson, and it was a Tony Richardson film about illegal aliens and things. That was a good one. Well, there's a few more.
Everyone's afraid to hire someone who doesn't have experience doing what it is you're hiring them to do. So you got hired to do the Long Riders soundtrack before you'd ever written for a film before. Did you have to fake it at first? Did you have to fool everybody into thinking that you really knew what you were doing?
Well, luckily for me, you know, I had done a lot of work with Jack Nitzsche, who had helped me had brought me to help him, and it helped me learn a way of doing this kind of work. And he was doing films in the 60s and 70s, and of course still is. And from working with him, I picked up a kind of a MO for myself, you know, and certainly found that I enjoyed looking at images and at stuff on the screen, and it was very natural for me to just sort of hear what went along with it. I think as a kid I used to hear the music and imagine the visuals, sort of, you might say. But the Long Riders didn't scare me. I just thought it was the easiest thing in the world. It's a snap. Show me your film, I'll score. Well, I found out better later on.
I should mention that The Long Riders is a Western about the James and the younger gangs. Mm-hmm. Now, I think your best-known soundtrack is what you wrote for Paris, Texas. Mm-hmm. You wrote this really kind of lonely, brooding kind of blues, but very, very kind of spacious with lots of space between notes, lots of just notes resonating. Do you know what I mean? Can you tell me a little bit how it certainly matches the mood of the movie? It's a pretty perfect fit, but maybe you could tell us a little bit how you came up with the sound for that film. Actually, before you tell us, why don't I play the most familiar part of that soundtrack? So maybe now you could tell us a little bit about, you know, creating that kind of mood musically.
Well, Wim called me up.
This is Wim Wenders, the director.
Wim Wenders, the director, called me from Berlin. He said he'd made a film. He wanted me to do the music. He'd see me in 3 days. So he came out to, and that was about all he said. He came out to Los Angeles, and he was in somebody's house, and he had this thing on video cassette, this film, Paris, Texas, which I knew nothing about, and went up there and took a look at it. With no music, just the empty, silent kind of strange interior monologue that this thing is, and I thought, well, Lord, you know, this is great, and it's very beautiful, and what? Hopefully, he'll know what he wants. You see, because it could go, you could do. People, you never know what directors are thinking, because you hope that they're thinking of something, but if they are, they better let you know, and it's important to pick up on the right thing so you don't go wasting everybody's time. So anyhow, he had found this Blind Willie Johnson piece. Actually, I had recorded it some years back, called Dark as the Night, which is a kind of a modal study. It's just a bottleneck song that Blind Willie, it's the music of the spheres. I mean, it's some sort of root note thing. It's some sort of cosmic mood piece that the great Blind Willie Johnson had laid down for all time. And as far as Wim Wenders is concerned, this was the territory to be in. This was the place to go for this guy, because it was going to be the music of the man, the Harry Dean Stanton character, Travis, what it was like to be in his head, you know, not to say that he goes around whistling this thing, but that he's coming from a place where things, if they had a musical identity, this is what it would be, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's nothing outside in this film except empty space, the sky and the ground and the railroad tracks. So you have to say, well, we're operating in some other conscious area here, you know. So we can't be too linear, we can't be too lyrical. If you have a lot of counterpoint, a lot of rhythm, and a lot of musical ideas going on, it's just going to turn this little film over and sink it. See, it's going to be like you're going to rock the boat too hard in a very sensitive situation. So I figured he knew what he wanted, and I could hear this piece, and what I did was I kind of broke it down to some even simpler elements, maybe four-note element, and began to take that little theme, as it were, and try to develop it in a way that it could be heard or felt, hopefully not as somebody thinking real hard, and hopefully not as somebody reacting real hard and using all their brain. And what you want to do in a situation like this is turn your brain off. You know, people say, oh, you're not using your brain here. Well, you can't operate in this way if you're using your brain too hard, because you're just thinking and thinking and thinking. So you want to shut it off and get to the thing that you feel, you know.
I think it was Molson's who used your theme for their beer commercial.
That's right.
So they must have come to you and asked for permission to use it. You had to sell it to them, right?
Actually, what I did was I went and played it, and I played it again. And of course, now I don't do this as a rule, but you know, I thought, well, let's try it and see. It got to be where people were. They still do want to use this thematic little thing. This little it's almost a cliche now. You want to hear this guitar out there with the kind of drone underneath, and I've had to, you know. Had to receive requests from cigarette companies and automobiles and cars and clothes, and they want to sell a lot of stuff with this, which is very odd because you certainly never had that in mind. And it's, you know, it's not it's the most unpackaged sound I can make, and yet right. It's the one that the packagers like the best. Isn't that odd? Isn't that strange?
Are you glad that you did this for Molson's? Has it helped you a lot financially in a good way and given you more freedom? Where do you draw the line about when to and when not to use music for a commercial?
No, the Molson thing was a fee job. It was a very small fee. It was very small, and it's money I probably put into the yard. You know, got some a bigger lemon tree or something. And, you know, you spend that money and then you don't even remember what... Those
I thought you would have made a fortune on that. They've used
it so much. I'm afraid not. I wouldn't mind making some real good money on an easy job, although the more I try to do that stuff, the harder... You know, you can't go and do it for other reasons. It doesn't quite work. The truth of the matter is that... The real rich advertising money comes from something I don't know what. It certainly wasn't Molson's. I guarantee you that.
So what are you working on now?
Well, we're doing Little Village, and that's a almost full-time job because it, you know, you have to go and play, and then you have to rest. That's part of your job is resting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go out again. We're getting ready to go out in Europe and come back through the United States, and I'm also sort of starting to wonder about a few things. You know, I used to spend a lot of time being with musicians and people in funny places, and I got a lot of enjoyment out of that, and I'm sort of starting to miss that now. I haven't done that in a long time. I got a kind of hankering to go out there and sit under a tree somewhere with somebody. I mean, who knows, you know? We'll see.
Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Rye Cooter. He's a member of the band Little Village, which has a new record called Little Village. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.